This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Todd Mickelson sitting in for Matt McNeil again. He is on vacation for the rest of this week. He'll be back after the 4th of July, which is the 5th of July. Is that? That's correct, right?
That's correct. I'll just throw in one note as well. Starting on July 5th, Matt will be at a new time. He will be from 3 to 5 every weekday, so make sure you tune in at 3 o'clock. Starting next Tuesday, July 5th, Matt McNeil, 3 to 5 every weekday, starting next Tuesday the 5th.
Yeah. Say, how did yesterday go? You were at the booth at Pride, right?
Yeah, it was fun. It was, I'd never been out there. It was very colorful, very spirited, a lot of people out there having fun.
Yeah, my daughter went on Saturday, and she and her friends just had a blast. Like I said last week, so many people that I know think it's like the funnest weekend in the Twin Cities of the year. So glad that that was fun. AM 950 had a booth there. So much going on. I do want to – we have to stay on track with everything that's going on. We can't be distracted by just one of the things that enrages us the most on any – certain day. So there is a lot going on, including it's looking like the Republican Party is finally kind of tiring of Trump and all this just going on and on. They stole it. They stole it from me. There's some interesting information about that I want to go through. And also, of course, the J6 committee. Right now, for what's being talked about the most is the Supreme Court. There's a lot to talk about as far as that goes, too. One thing that popped in my head that I thought, hey, I'm going to do this on the radio because it's just a fun thing, and we have to remember all the things that we're interested in our lives as well. We have to keep moving forward on things that we like to do. We can't stop playing guitar. We can't stop. Being a geek who likes to dig into historical stories and UFOs. Oh, I watched some interesting stuff about UFOs today. It ties into John Kerry going to what's the big ice mass on the southern part of the Earth? What Antarctica. Oh, no, it's going to be one of those days for me again where I can't remember names. But here's a story that I learned a few years ago, and I was reminded of it and popped back in my head today about time. And it was partially reminded because of the new clock system we have here at AM 950, the high-tech broadcast equipment here in the building. One of the things it does is brings you the precise time. It wasn't very long ago where people were setting their watches at noon when they saw the sun was at the highest point in the sky. We didn't start to have an agreed time, a standard time, until the 1880s. And it was because of trains, actually. When the trains were running, it was very confusing to try and make schedules. So the train companies started to just recognize their own standard time. And it was the train companies that divvied the United States into four time zones, and that way they were able to set times for trains arriving and leaving. And then shortly after that, a Minnesota businessman, Richard Sears, who was at that time working at a railroad. He was a telegraph officer. He was working at a railroad, and he thought, now everybody's checking their watches. I see all these people working for the trains checking their watches. I see all the passengers checking their watches. I'm going to sell watches. So he bought a bunch of watches, and then he set it up so people could order them, and then he would deliver them via the trains. So it was he was kind of a pioneer in, kind of almost like online shopping, where you don't see the item in a store. You order it, and then you receive it a couple days later when the trains deliver it. And that trains made all that possible. And then he ended up finding that they started that in 1883, and about a year later he started selling watches, and then maybe a year after that he partnered up with a guy named Alva Roebuck, who was a watchmaker. So then he started making, you know, they made their own watches, and then he's thought, this is working so well, I'm going to sell other stuff. And then he came up with the whole catalog, the Sears catalog, and it was the very first catalog you could shop from. And it was as recently as the 1880s, 1890s. I think the first store opened in something like early 1890s, the first Sears and Roebuck store by those two guys. And then finally the United States actually recognized the same time zones, not until 1918. So I thought that was a pretty interesting – and a Minnesota tie. I always remember as a kid that my dad would say Sears is a Minnesota company, even though the first store opened in Chicago. But Richard Sears is from Minnesota. We need to take the time to think about interesting little tidbits like that. At least I think it. I don't know, Patrick. Do you think that's interesting or just boring geek stuff?
I think it's kind of both, because I think if you really get into that sort of geek stuff, then people – They kind of go, I don't really get it, but I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I just think it's interesting. Everything has to have a beginning, and nobody really thinks about how things actually began. And that particular story, you know, who thinks about when time zones started, you know? How did they do it when they were at war, 700 years ago? What's the whole deal with time? Who made it up? It's weird. Anyway, I'm fascinated with stories about the origins of things. But we're here to also we want to, you know, we're staying on track as far as being sane human beings. You know, we're paying attention to UFOs. We're playing our guitars. We're doing the things we like to do. Things keep moving forward. Last week was a big week, a historic week. On Thursday, the Supreme Court changed a gun regulation that was in New York City beginning in 1913. Now, we were just talking about the 1880s. Let's go back a little further to like the 1870s when America, after the Civil War, a big focus was to start to expand out west. That's when we started fighting with the indigenous people, taking away their land, because we were moving west and basically taking the land from them without asking permission. So everyone had guns. It was the gunslinging Wild West. But in the gunslinging Wild West of the 1870s, almost every town, like towns like Deadwood, Gravestone. Tombstone. Oh God, I'm having one of those days. You're gonna have to really listen closely, Patrick, and you're gonna have to finish half of my sentences because I'm having can't remember names. Tombstone, where the big high noon shootout happened. The reason that happened was because some of the guys would not give up their guns when they came into town. So the sheriff and a couple of his friends went out there to confiscate their guns, because the rule, even in Tombstone, which was, you know, one of the most dangerous cowboy, out of control, chaotic towns at the time, the rule was that you couldn't carry your handgun. You couldn't – there was no conceal and carry allowed. You had to leave your gun with the sheriff, come in and have a couple drinks and do all the other things they used to do that we can't say on the radio. And then you could get your guns when you left town. Well, New York City passed a handgun law in 1913 when it was still kind of, you know, I mean, in out west there was still some gunslinging going on. But New York City decided, you know, it's just too dangerous to have everybody out of control with their guns in the most populated city in the country. And so they had a handgun ban. And a lot of people think that's a new thing. It started in 1913, 109 years ago, and the Supreme Court decided that they were going to overrule that. That happened last Thursday. For instance, First Amendment rights, the right to free speech, unfettered right to free speech. That's why people can say things that you disagree with. And they can say it anywhere they want to. The FCC used to have regulations as far as what you could broadcast, but those regulations were mostly lifted even in the 1980s. So basically, you can say anything you want to pretty much anywhere, except you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. That's a law that was made in 1919. Charlie Chaplin was making movie theaters really popular, and they realized how much I don't know if there was an actual incident. I should look that up, but there probably was, and that's probably a very interesting story. But when people panic and everybody tries to get out of a room where there's only one or two small doors, people get hurt, and that's why they passed that law. It's like, well, okay, we're infringing a little bit on our First Amendment right here by forbidding anybody to yell fire in a crowded theater. Actual law. It's not just a saying. So people accept that. George Will, who's a very far-right conservative, he said that it was unprecedented for SCOTUS to do this because up till then, the Second Amendment right was always balanced with public safety. Cities and states could set their own regulations about what they thought was safe. That's why New York City was able to have their own law banning handguns in their town. Now, the other thing about what SCOTUS did last week, you know, and you may have heard talk about this, they went one way on one thing and the opposite way on the other thing. So that's the way they went on handguns. They made it a national rule that no town can have their own gun laws. No state can proclaim their own gun regulations. But on the other big ruling, they went in the opposite direction. We'll talk about that when we come back. Let's take a short break. You're listening to AM 950. The Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Call 952-946-6205 if you have anything to add. This is Todd Mickelson sitting in for Matt McNeil. We'll be right back. You're just another recovering heart. Yes, on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Some progressive rock for the Progressive Voice. Were you going to say something? You looked like you were going to say something.
Yeah, unfortunately, 7 years ago today, we lost the great Chris Squire from Yes, so only fitting that that's in Matt's playlist today.
Ah. Oh, I see. Okay. 7 years ago today. What did he play? I wasn't the hugest Yes fan. I like him, but
he was the bass guitarist.
Bass guitar.
Yes. You hear that kind of rumbling riff on Roundabout, that
yeah.
Was him.
Yeah, that very cool bass on that. Oh, yeah, I'm remembering when they got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and then Geddy Lee played bass for him.
Yep, sadly, Chris had passed away by the time that performance took place.
But yeah.
It was good that Geddy was able to join them that evening.
Yeah, because, of course, he kicked. Can we say butt?
We can.
Okay. What we were talking about was the SCOTUS ruling going in one direction, taking away states' rights in the gun ruling, and then taking away a national right in the other ruling and giving it back to the states. And that ruling is the Roe v. Wade, lifting Roe v. Wade, which was a national constitutional right for women to have a right to an abortion if she wanted or needed it. And of course, everybody set regulations on it, and it didn't go so far as to say you can just decide, you know, 10 minutes before you're going to have your baby to just abort it because you changed your mind. That's not allowed anywhere and hasn't been for the last 50 years. But now they've taken away the right altogether. And more comes out about it. To understand it better, for instance, here's one story from one woman. She writes, I've had 4 miscarriages, 3 of which were pretty far along and required aborting a dead fetus. Never grasped the true meaning of a woman and her doctor until my OB walked me through my options after my first miscarriage. Cops encroaching on that moment would have been obscene. And that's what's going to happen now. If you have a miscarriage, a lot of states are going to have it be so that you are then going to be investigated to make sure that it wasn't an abortion. An OBGYN doctor makes a point. Abortion for lethal fetal anomalies is now illegal in Ohio. I'm a high-risk obstetrician here. I diagnose birth defects. So some point soon, I may look someone in the eyes and say that they, against their will carry to term, undergo delivery, and then have their child die. These are the kind of things that we're talking about here. It's not just somebody deciding to have an abortion because they think they made a mistake. That's not what this is about. Another thing this is about is a lot of clinics that offer abortions are the only places for many women, especially low-income women and people of color, to get any of their health care needs. That's why we're calling it what it is, a woman's right to reproductive health care, really a woman's right to health care. A lot of these clinics are going to be forced to close, and that means a lot of women are going to have no access to any health care. That's what we're talking about. Now, of course, in Minnesota, there was a good article, if I can find it here, of course, from our good friends at the Minnesota Reformer. What does it mean in Minnesota? Okay. For Minnesota, how does the court's decision change abortion law in Minnesota? It doesn't. Minnesota legal precedent still guarantees the right to an abortion. The Minnesota Supreme Court ruled in the 1995 case, Doe versus Gomez, that abortion rights are protected by the state's constitution. Think of it as Minnesota's own Roe v. Wade. So here in Minnesota, we have our own constitution that gives a woman rights to an abortion if she wants or needs it. The Minnesota Supreme Court is made up of 7 justices, and 5 of them are appointed by either Governor Mark Dayton, Governor Tim Walz, both Democrats. For the moment, Doe v. versus Gomez appears to be safe. So you hear that we must hold on to the House and we must win the Senate back and we must hold on to the governor's seat. And those are all true because Republicans have said here in Minnesota that they will change that. They all of the top candidates running for attorney general, governor, the secretary of state, even though that person doesn't have a lot to do with this, but of course their candidate for secretary of state doesn't understand what her job would be if she were to become secretary of state. So, and it's true about their gubernatorial candidate, too, does not understand what his job would be if he was elected. There's another funny story about him and his buddy, Matt Burke, that we'll talk about, hopefully get to at some point. So here's another thing. Are there restrictions on abortion in Minnesota? Yes. Regulations include the requirement to receive state-directed counseling that includes information designed to discourage the patient from having an abortion and then wait 24 hours before the procedure is provided. That's something that Republicans push for really hard. I actually disagree with that because it's still trying to push a woman to make a decision not on her own. So I'm against that particular regulation. But also both parents of a minor must be notified. I don't know how I feel about that one either. I have a daughter and, you know, I think that she would notify us. I think that we would be a part of her decision in that case, but that's because of what our particular situation is and the way that our relationship with our daughter. Some people don't have a great relationship with their parents. Some young girls are raped by their father. So I don't think that's a great regulation. A group of abortion rights advocates are currently challenging the restrictions in court. There are also rules about I think it's up to 24 weeks, if I'm not mistaken. I believe that's in Minnesota, where anything after 24 weeks has to threaten the life of the mother in order for it to be to have an abortion. I'm pretty sure that is also a restriction. I know that's a restriction in almost – well, I think it might – that might even be the national restriction with Roe v. Wade. Come to think of it, I think that's what that is. So Minnesota doesn't have that regulation on their own because it is part of Roe v. Wade. After 24 weeks, you can't have an abortion unless the life of the mother is being threatened. Now, here's the thing, another point made here by the Minnesota Reformer. The GOP is optimistic about the November election. What happens if they win a trifecta? If Republicans win both chambers of the legislature and presumptive GOP nominee Scott Jensen is elected governor, they'll probably move to enact new regulations and restrictions on abortion, which in turn would invite litigation from abortion rights groups. The court would likely rule against the Republicans because, like we said earlier, the Minnesota Supreme Court is made up of people who would not agree with the Republicans on this. Going on, the GOP majority House and Senate could also propose an amendment to the Minnesota Constitution banning abortion. If it passed both chambers, voters would get to decide during the next general election. Republicans took this approach in 2012 when they asked voters to approve amendments banning gay marriage and requiring voters to present an ID at the polls. Both were defeated resoundingly, by the way. And Republicans lost both chambers in the 2012 election. The effort to amend the Constitution was widely considered to be a debacle for the GOP.
It's important to note, of course, that even if Walz is reelected, but the GOP gets both chambers, they do not need Walz's approval. He cannot prevent them from putting that on the ballot.
That's correct. That is correct. So even if we keep the governor's seat, the GOP Senate and House could try and pass these amendments. Now, I think it would be at least as much of a debacle as it was in 2012. The fact that the GOP is optimistic about the November election is rather silly of them. I think in Minnesota, it's incredibly difficult for the GOP. They have not won a statewide election since 2006, and that includes all of the governor, the secretary of state, the attorney general. Republicans have been unable to win that in Minnesota for 15, 16 years now. And so I really don't understand why they're so optimistic after what went on with Trump and now with the J6 things going on and now after the Supreme Court is scaring the crap out of everybody because they're not stopping with Roe v. Wade. They have said they're coming after gay marriage. They're coming after contraception. They want to make it so that married couples do not have access to contraception. Yet you also, can't have an abortion. It's crazy. And 90% of Americans are completely against them on that. Yet they think they're going to win these midterm elections. I think they're pretty doomed. And there is a point made, a really good short point made by, if I can find it. Well, basically, it's that officials on the Republican side who know about how elections work are a lot more worried after these decisions than the Democrats are. And that's because – well, here it is. They're officially the dog that caught the car. This is an angry staffer on Twitter. If it makes you feel any better – GOP strategists are far more concerned today than their Dem counterparts. They're officially the dog that caught the car, and now they don't know what to do with it. They've also lost a campaign message. They can't really fight against Roe v. Wade anymore when Roe v. Wade is not a thing anymore. They can't say, elect us so that we overturn Roe v. Wade. They can't say that anymore. And I believe most Republicans wanted it to stay that way so that they could use that. I think most Republicans didn't think Roe v. Wade was actually going to get turned over either, and they've been using it as a battle cry for 50 years, and now they can't do that anymore. They can't yell about that anymore. So, you know, now what you going to talk about? So much more to talk about here on AM 950. Let's take a break and come back. You're listening to the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I'm Todd Mickelson. We'll be right back. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. And we're back. I was going to go on a little bit more about this. Abortion is likely to remain legal here in Minnesota for a while, but what about our neighbors? The Minnesota Reformer goes on. North Dakota and South Dakota have enacted so-called trigger laws so that abortion will now be illegal there. That means right now. Wisconsin, right now. Abortion is illegal. There are pro-Roe law on the books that criminalizes abortion. Democratic Tony Evers called a special session of the legislature there to try and legalize abortion, but the lawmakers left the 1849 abortion ban in place. Last week, the Iowa Supreme Court ruled that the state constitution does not provide a right to abortion, paving the way for an abortion ban there. The legislature there has already begun enacting requirements and restrictions, and it's probably just going to get worse. Minnesota is going to be an island, if you don't count Canada, where people can get abortions. Can we handle that? Minnesota's a refuge for abortion rights. Minnesota organizations are getting ready to help people come here for abortions, because we're expecting people to come from all the surrounding states. Emily Moorbacher, who is the director of client services at Midwest Access Coalition, told the Reformer back in 2020 that we're prepared to support many more people as Roe is potentially dismantled bit by bit. She said she expects operation costs will rise as they help more people, and they expect communities of color to be disproportionately affected. Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison said in a news release Tuesday that no one will be prosecuted in Minnesota for seeking or helping someone else seek or provide an abortion that is legal in Minnesota. So are there problems with that? Yeah. The abortion rights group called Unrestricted Minnesota, they count eight providers in Minnesota, specifically providing abortion here, most in the Twin Cities, with one in Rochester and one in Duluth. So a steep rise in demand from people traveling from out of state. And they actually expanded and built – I didn't even realize this, but just by the airport, sits a brick one-story building with opaque windows. From the nearby freeways, most drivers wouldn't recognize this as a location of one of the few clinics in the state that provides abortions. Basically, they began working on it in February. They opened it in February. They've been getting it more and more ready because of that leak of what SCOTUS was going to do back in February. They realized, okay, this looks like it's coming. So Minnesota has been bracing for it for quite a while and trying to see if we can get up to speed to help the influx of people coming from other states. Meanwhile, DeSantis vetoes $2 million in birth control funding for Florida. Actually, a Republican set – let's see if I can find his – yeah. When Ron DeSantis slashed $3 billion from the state's budget last Thursday, one ill-fated item sounded familiar. Just as he did last year, DeSantis vetoed $2 million meant to help low-income people access long-acting birth control. It was against Senate President Wilton Simpson, a Pasco County Republican, who included it in the $110 billion budget. Unlike last year, though, this veto landed amid a national reckoning on reproductive rights. So the Republican legislature in Florida has been trying to maintain money for low-income people to have access to long-acting birth control, and DeSantis has been vetoing that. He doesn't think they can take $2 million out of a $110 billion budget to help low-income people have access to birth control. And it sounds like the Supreme Court is going to basically, you know, try and make birth control not the right of anybody so that states can outlaw that as well if they want to. It feels like a crazy, crazy world that we're living in. But there, as you know, if you've listened to me before, I'm always optimistic. And we'll talk about some good news maybe then when we come back. Let's take a little bit of an earlier break and come back and talk about some happier things, some better things. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. We'll be right back.
Hey, boy.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. We are back. And this just in, Rupert Murdoch uses media empire to publicly dump Trump. A lot of people are starting to talk about that the Republicans are just kind of moving on from Trump. And if you think about it, you know, he's still having these rallies, but they're not really being talked about. I didn't even realize he was having rallies anymore. I guess he had one on Saturday. The only reason it made the news is because of this woman, Representative Miller, Mary Miller, where she did a gaffe where she thanks Trump for a victory for white life. And we'll maybe talk a little bit more about that later on because that actually raises another issue and story. But here's a little story. The Murdoch family, they own Fox News, Wall Street Journal, New York Post, and a host of other right-wing media properties. They have officially moved on from Donald Trump, and they hope other Republicans will too. They're now using their vast media empire to slam the delusional ex-president with scathing op-eds and editorials in the Murdoch's-owned Wall Street Journal and The Post, and even on Fox News, apparently tired of Trump's antics and his obsession with the 2020 election. In an op-ed for the New York Post, former Trump ally Pierce Morgan referred to Trump as an aging, raging gorilla who's become a whiny, democracy-defying bore. He then urged his readers to dump Trump. Morgan's op-ed came just 10 days after the New York Post editorial board referred to Trump as the King Lear of Mar-a-Lago and said that the events of January 6th were a national shame. The Post editorial went on to say, but Trump has become a prisoner of his own ego. He can't admit his tweeting and narcissism turned off millions. He won't stop insisting that 2020 was stolen, even though he's offered no proof that it's true. That's another thing that Republicans are are sick of is all of these other Republicans talking about that the 2020 election was stolen. There was tons of evidence, but they never provide any of the evidence. The January 6th hearings have also played a major role in the about-face away from Trump. Wall Street Journal editorial board wrote, "The person who owns January 6th is Trump. Calling Trump out on his 2020 election lies, Mr. Trump betrayed his supporters by conning them on January 6th, and he's still doing it." Wall Street Journal's Peggy Noonan, longtime Republican supporter, although trying to be stealthy about it. Peggy Noonan called the January 6th hearings a powerful indictment, well-documented and undeniable. Noonan referred to those who stormed the Capitol in Trump's name as stupid. She called out Trump's lack of patriotism and acknowledges that if he ran again in 2024, he'd lose. She says America isn't going to elect him again. They're not going to let that guy back in that house because everyone knows it. Let Donald Trump back there and he'll do a 1-6 again. Because while his followers love America, he doesn't. He likes it as far as it goes, appreciates it as the stage for his greatness, but beyond that, nothing. No other prospective 2024 candidate would have an excuse, would have to excuse January 6th, writes Rich Laurie from the New York Post. They would not have to parrot the most outlandish claims about the 2020 election. When you think about that, I think all Republicans are just getting sick of it. Just getting tired of hearing about the 2020 election. You know, I think they want to start thinking about the 2024 election, and you don't see the Republican Party doing that. The Republican Party is stuck in the past, as they've always been. The Murdoch exodus from Trump isn't relegated to print. In response to Trump's unsubstantiated stolen election claims, Fox News anchor Martha McCallum admits the lack of proof is stunning. According to The Hill, she said, "The lack of evidence is the huge, stunning, clear moment here where these people are saying, look, I supported you. Please give me something to work with." And it simply doesn't materialize. Yeah, this article goes on about that. There was something else I saw that was really interesting. A GOP strategist by the name of Sarah Longwell. She says the GOP is finally moving on from Trump. She has been having these little forums with Trump supporters, so kind of asking them, you know, doing sort of surveys and asking them about the January 6th hearings. And she's very surprised because when she did these about things like the Kevin McCarthy tapes coming out a couple months ago with the recordings of Kevin McCarthy right after January 6th, and everybody was playing them. And I think a couple of reporters got their hands on it and everybody was playing them. And it was kind of a lead up to the January 6th hearings that we're now having. She said, when I mentioned those, they had no idea what I was talking about. That was, you know, I want to say about 2 months ago. And now the January 6th hearings are going on and, you know, they still might think that you know, it's a dog and pony show or a witch hunt or whatever. They might not even be watching them, but they sure know they're going on. And I saw, I mean, she was really surprised at how Trump supporters are. They really know about January 6th and they're not really. She said that still like 50 or more percent of them really wanted Trump to run in 2024, and now she says that's not the case. It's more like, you know, 30%, 20% still want him to run in 2024. Most people are getting excited about somebody else like Rick DeSantis, which is another horrible thing. But they're moving on from – I think he's on the comedy – Jordan Klepper, who – I think he's on the Comedy Network, but – he takes a microphone to Trump rallies and he asks Trump supporters things. And again, it's been different with him. You know, he would ask about whatever's going on. He's been doing this for a couple of years. and they just say crazy stuff. And he kind of makes it into a comedy skit because these people are more funny than any comedy writer could write. And but now he actually had a laptop whatever you call them, Andrew, or I can't even remember your name, Patrick. iPad. Oh, God. I'm losing it. He had an iPad, and he would play parts of the January 6th hearings to some of these people. You know, he's outdoors, out in the field, playing them these. And you can see on their face that they hesitate. You can see that they're surprised. You know, he played them the clip of Bill Barr saying that everything that Trump's lawyers are putting out there, everything that Trump is saying about this, you know, Bill Barr said, I told him it was BS. And he actually used the actual BS words. And this guy, Jordan Klepper, he would play this for these Trump supporters. And you can see them hesitate, like they're sincerely surprised. And then they'll hesitate. There's silence. And then they'll say, well, I don't, you know, that could have just been edited. And then he's like, well, you know, that is at least a sentence, and that is Trump's attorney general. Trump chose him. Trump loved him. You know, and then they would say, well, he ended up turning on Trump later, you know. And then he would play him another clip. He played him the clip of Ivanka Trump and, you know, Ivanka saying, yeah, I agree with Bill Barr, meaning that she agrees that everything Trump is saying about the 2020 election is false, i.e. BS. And one guy said, that could be a clone of her. So they're still crazy, but you can see a difference. They're stopping. They're surprised. They're hesitating. They're thinking. It goes back to what I said when I was on last week, on last Friday, I think, or last Wednesday, I think I said, the de-radicalization is a careful and slow process of incrementally showing the truth in small doses. So these people are starting to incrementally get the truth in small doses, and it is making them hesitate, and it is making them pause.
You know, I'll go drive around in rural Minnesota and North Dakota, and I've noticed a lot less Trump regalia than I did. Even, you know, several months after the 2020 election, you know, it was still Trump signs and flags everywhere, and now I don't really see very many of those anymore.
Yeah, I think they're just getting tired of him for in a lot of ways, because he's just like, they stole the election, we won so big, we won by overwhelming the likes of which nobody's ever seen. You know, they're just getting sick of it. Even they are just getting sick of it.
Hey, you know, and another thought is, you know, even though as many times as, you know, he said we won the election, and people kind of still, you know, they have to admit he's still not there. And they kind of probably go, well, when are you going to take the White House if you won?
Yeah, yeah. And all the crazy stuff that they were saying where, you know, Joe Biden has a fake Oval Office in his basement and Trump is still the president. You know, they can't hope for that kind of stuff anymore. It's just done. And enough time has passed. I hope they stay, you know, distracted by it going into the elections. But, you know, more to come in hour number two. You're listening to the Progressive Voice of Minnesota, AM 950. The Progressive Voice of Minnesota, AM 950. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in on the Matt McNeil Show. Matt is on vacation. He'll be back on the 5th of July, actually at 3 o'clock instead of 4 o'clock. His time is changing from 3 to 5. So if you're a Matt fan, you want to tune in at 3 instead of 4, starting the 5th. Huh, I didn't even plan that ahead. This just in. House Select January 6th Committee drops a surprise hearing added for tomorrow at 1 p.m. Witness testimony promised. You may have heard about that, but it was only about 4 hours ago. This is Very interesting, though, because the U.S. House is back home in a district work period this week. Many staffers are on vacation or headed toward the July 4th exits. A last-minute public hearing in Washington during a recess week has hints of urgency and possible bombshell. The committee released names of witnesses for prior hearings. They're not doing so ahead of tomorrow. It adds a layer of intrigue and hints at a blockbuster, which is how this needs to be done. It's how we get people to watch it. It's how we get people interested. Committee members have been unequivocal. They expect to continue investigating and interviewing even after the scheduled hearings conclude, raising the prospect of additional hearings later this summer, maybe even this fall. It's fluid at this point. The committee is very efficient getting its ducks in a row. Staff confirms that Representative Adam Schiff, Zoe Lofgren, Elaine Luria, she's from Virginia, both Schiff and Lofgren are from California. They will be attending tomorrow's hearing in person, so they're on their way back to D.C. Also, Representative Peter Aguilar from California, Adam Kinzinger from Illinois, Republican, actually, and Stephanie Murphy from Florida will be attending tomorrow's J6 committee hearing as well. And they're purposefully not telling us what's going on, but they are purposefully telling us it's because of what they've learned very recently. They had postponed the rest of the hearings until July, which is only, you know, a little more than a week from now. They would probably start letting out the schedule. But now they're saying that this one, they need to urgently have it. They learned something that they think is important enough that they added an unscheduled committee hearing. And that starts tomorrow at, well, it's 1 p.m. D.C. time. If you want to pay attention to it here in Minnesota, you need to tune in at noon. And I have been watching all of them, and my mind has been being blown over and over again. And like I said last week, I read four of those books. I think there's a total of six that were written that came out after January 6th. And some of them were written by people that weren't expecting to really write about the Trump administration anymore, but they were finding out so many more things about what happened after the election leading up to January 6th, and then even things that were going on after January 6th. They were interviewing Trump in Mar-a-Lago, you know, as late as like March and April. And they thought, okay, now I got to write another book, because most of these people had written one or two books during the Trump administration. And I actually read all these because I'm enough of a White House fan and you know, presidential administration and history fan that all the stuff that was going on in Trump's White House is just insane, much beyond what anyone could imagine. And then these books that came out after January 6th, they started to be released last summer or even late summer. And but they wrote these books really quickly. I read four of them, and the four were different enough from each other. There was some redundancies, but not a lot. All of these different reporters and authors were getting different administration. I mean, all of these authors were reporters, at least at some point in their life, are currently investigative reporters. And the interviews, the stuff Trump was saying in these interviews, and then the stories, some of which we're hearing about in the January 6th committee hearings. And like I said, my wife Heidi's reaction, who she had not read these books. So she didn't really know about, say, the meeting that happened where they got in a big fight when he was going to try and make Jeffrey Clark take over as the attorney general. And then Jeff Rosen basically would get kicked out, and he and another lawyer, Donahue, said that there would be a mass exodus. So I knew that from reading those books. I knew about that meeting. Heidi didn't even know about that meeting. So when she was watching this stuff, and we weren't watching together because I was at my shop doing work and I had it on in the background. She was, you know, either in the office doing the office work or whatever. So we were watching it separately. And then that evening, you know, we would get together and talk about it. And she was telling me these stories and her mind was just being blown over and over. And a lot of the times I would say, oh, I knew about that meeting, but I didn't know this about that meeting. So there's still, even I who had read all this stuff, am learning so many mind-blowing, mind-numbing things watching these January 6th committee hearings. This is, I mean, it is entertainment TV. It's gripping. It's fascinating. It's unbelievable. You could not write professional, get the best comedy and situational comedy and just overall comedy cliffhanger writers get the best in the world together, and they could not write as compelling a story as this. As a matter of fact, if they did, nobody would accept it because everyone would just go, what? That would never happen. That's not going to ever happen in the White House. You can't be president and do that and say that. But, you know, that began happening, especially when that tape of Trump talking about grabbing the, can we say kitty on the air?
Yeah, I think we know what comment he was.
Exactly.
I'm not laughing at the comment. I'm just...
I'm trying to kind of be a little funny. It was a little funny to say kitty, I think. Anyway, I think that we all, that's when we really started to see, wow, the Republican Party's still hanging on to this guy. And then he wins the election. Of course, there was, sounds like a lot of influence by Russia going on. But still, the unbelievable of the unbelievable. And it's been going on for so long and still... These January 6th committee hearings are revealing even more absolutely as used to being, you know, as kind of callous to all this unbelievableness as we've become. These are still just absolutely unbelievable. And I swear it's just as entertaining. I've been watching this new show with Jeff Bridges in it and John Lithgow called The Old Man. I don't know if you've heard of that show. It's on. You can get it on Hulu. I think it's made by FX. Are you a Jeff Bridges fan?
Not in particular.
Maybe it's an older person thing. I've always been a Jeff Bridges fan. What about John Lithgow?
I can't really say I'm a fan or a fan or not a fan.
Well, I've always been a John Lithgow fan too. Like Third Rock from the Sun. You know that show?
That was a show. One of the first shows I think I remember as a kid, not because I was a fan of it, because, oh, that's a show on TV that I can put a name on. It also, I thought it was cool because it had the, you know, when it would shift from scene to scene, it would have the shots of planets and the sun. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was cool. And that's why I think a big reason why you don't care that much about John Lithgow or Jeff Bridges. John Lithgow was absolutely insanely hilarious on that show, and I was already a fan of his before that. But yeah, it's a you were too young to really get it. I mean, don't take that as an insult. You were very young. You know, you're doing a lot better now as far as your cognitive reasoning.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that.
Sure. Anyway. I don't know if these January 6th committee hearings are as entertaining or much of a cliffhanger as this show with Jeff Bridges and John Lithgow, but that show is purposefully made to be mind-blowingly cliffhangering, unbelievable, and riveting. Whereas these January 6th committee hearings are, you know, Congress people asking a question of somebody who's sitting at a table, and they're going back and forth, you know, in a parliamentary manner. And it's still absolutely riveting entertainment TV. The stories are insane. And now we've got an unscheduled one happening tomorrow, and they won't tell us what's going to happen. So they're even handling it like, you know, must-watch TV, which I think is working because more and more people are – I've been even hearing as far as people signing up, changing parties and registering to vote. That's pretty hard to gauge, so I don't really trust some of the sources that I've been seeing that from. I'm hoping to find out more from one of those sources, and then I would talk about it on the radio. But, you know, I've been seeing a lot of people just on Twitter, not people I even know really, talking about things like, you know, my mom voted for Trump twice, and now she thinks he's a monster because she watched these hearings. My dad, I finally got him to watch one of these hearings, and now he wants to watch all of them because he couldn't believe it, you know, and he was a Trump supporter. And so, you know, if for the people who are actually watching this stuff, I think it's really, really sinking in. And even for the people who aren't watching it, who are still trying to deny that it's happening, I think that they realize that it's, you know, everything's kind of in crisis. So, and that by that I mean kind of the Republican Party. So, yeah, the J6 committee hearings, watch tomorrow at noon on wherever you get you can watch it on TV. I mean, there's many, 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 many sources because it's everywhere except Fox News, which is another story that didn't go the way they were hoping it would. But anyway, we're a little overdue for a break. Why don't we take a short break and come back? You're listening to AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Yeah. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. We are back. Again, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez makes some very valid points here. She writes in a Twitter thread, "Here's how Dems can and must do more than wait for an election. Let's start with why. 7 of the 9 justices were appointed by a party that hasn't won a popular vote more than once in 30 years. One of those seats was stolen. Several lied to Congress to secure their appointment." So basically, I think that those who listen to this station know what's being talked about here. The seat that was stolen was Gorsuch's seat because Mitch McConnell disallowed a hearing in the Senate to approve of the first African-American president's choice. And that's exactly why Mitch McConnell was against Barack Obama. It was a racist, white supremacist thing. That's the seat that was stolen. Several lied to Congress to secure their appointment. There were 4 of them: Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, Alito, and Gorsuch. All were asked at their hearings, their approval hearings, and they all said they were asked, "Would you try and turn over Roe v. Wade?" And they all said, "Nope. Roe v. Wade is codified in, you know, basically it's part of the Constitution, and it has been for a long time, and the Supreme Court has ruled it in that direction numerous times. So no, I would not seek to vote to bring down Roe v. Wade." Of course, they all lied. One justice's family was paid by right-wing groups for years, and he never disclosed it, violating federal law. That's Clarence Thomas. His wife was bringing in tons of extra money because of the position he was in, and he never talked about it. He violated federal law by not disclosing it. It doesn't matter what you think of the moral aspects of him just making extra money because his wife is his wife and he's a SCOTUS judge, but he must have thought there was something bad about it because he hid it, and that violates federal law. So How many are we up to? That's, well, five, because Gorsuch is both the stolen seat and one of the liars. And then you add Thomas. So that's five out of nine that, you know, have basically committed impeachable offenses at the very least. Actually, Thomas, that same justice, his spouse also participated in the January 6th debacle, and he used his SCOTUS seat to vote to keep potential info related to his wife from investigators in Congress. Two justices stand very credibly accused of sexual assault, and that's the tip of the iceberg. All of that stuff is the tip of the iceberg, so says OAC. Election or not, the Supreme Court has a legitimacy crisis, and the public reaffirms it. 75% of the U.S. public reports lacking confidence in SCOTUS, and those numbers were pre-Roe. That was before this last Friday. I think the number would be even higher now. It's been made extremely obvious that the Supreme Court is nothing but a political tool. They are, in fact, not the Supreme Court. They are the political tool of basically the Christian white supremacist movement in this country. In a legitimacy crisis, the solution Biden plus Dem leaders must offer can't just be one of voting, but of statute and authority. This is, again, AOC talking. Compared to executive versus legislative branch, checks on court overreach and misconduct are little to none. Leaders must share their plans for Roe and a rogue court. Past presidents, from Lincoln to FDR, understood the dangerous stakes of allowing an unchecked court overreach its authority and threaten our democracy. Lincoln ignored the court to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. FDR, in the plunges of the Great Depression, also sought to confront the court's structure and core – I can't read that word. I don't need – I'm not sure what it means. But while he did not succeed, that check came from the people and Congress, not from SCOTUS. She goes on with a lot more ideas of what can be done, but – what she's basically talking about in history here, FDR, SCOTUS was threatening to not rule in favor of things like the Social Security issue. And FDR said, okay, well, I'm just going to put more people on the court then. And then they backed off. Then SCOTUS backed off, and FDR was able to pass Social Security. Lincoln... he ignored the court to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. Lincoln basically said back then that he thought it was legal for him to do it because they were at war. The Civil War was raging, and he's the president of the United States, and it was basically a war issue. You know, it's a war emergency. So the president has emergency status at that point to do whatever he wants, and he did some unprecedented things. He threw the legislature of Massachusetts in jail for a few days at one point. Habeas corpus. He got rid of habeas corpus in that case. So, but he was doing those things under the guise of that we were at war, and he was the president. And so it's very, very interesting stuff, but basically what she's leads to is what I've said many times, is that one of the things that could be done, and it's been pointed out by some people that I agree with, here, Palmer Report says, unlike most folks on here, Joe Biden understands how politics works. He strategically starts off by saying he doesn't want to have to expand the Supreme Court, knowing the public will swiftly come to demand it, and then he can say he's reluctantly doing it. That's what FDR would have done had it kept going. But I agree with Palmer here. Joe Biden, if you remember when he first became president, everybody was saying he should put more people on the court. And he said, well, you know what? I'm going to start this committee to check on that, and we're going to investigate. We're going to see the viability of doing that. But I'm not just going to do it. You know, I'm reluctant to do that. And then, of course, a bunch of Democrats get all mad at him and stuff. And then 2 years later, he's got a much better reason for doing it. And then maybe he will do it. We'll see. But I know people keep saying that that is stacking the court. Now, of course, he's going to pick probably some, you know, people that he agrees with, certainly a lot more than the monsters that the Republican Party put in there who lied to their committee. They lied to Congress in order to get the approval of the Senate. They lied personally to many Congress people, and then they lied under oath as well. In the country we were 6 years ago, that would have gotten them impeached. But it's not stacking the court. It's not merely trying to get the court to now be your political tool instead of the other guy's political tool. It is time for us to take another break, and I will explain that. You've heard me explain it before, but I'll explain it again when we come back at AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Todd Mickelson sitting in for Matt McNeil. We'll be right back. And by the way, Warner Stallion, we just got a new microwave because our old one putzed out, and they did a great job. They sent somebody over. We had a weird – our house is very old. We had a weird size for it to fit into in the cupboards, and Warner Stallion made it work, and it was very affordable, and we were able to get one in 2 days, and somebody come out and install it. They're a great company, Minnesota family-owned. I support them, just like the guy said, support our sponsors. Anyway, Todd Mickelson sitting in for Matt McNeil on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. I was talking about the Supreme Court and the amount of SCOTUS judges. And I've gone through this before, but we should never call it stacking the court. It hasn't been updated properly. George Washington, when he became president, it came to the decision that the Supreme Court should have three justices because there was, North, Middle, and South, basically. They were just trying to figure out, how to set up a circuit that each judge could be the head of. And that's kind of what SCOTUS is supposed to be. It's supposed to be the head of all of the courts across the whole country. And there are appellate circuits. So there, you hear the term circuit court. They raised the amount of circuits, and during the third president, which was Thomas Jefferson. So in the early 1800s, they decided that there was going to be seven circuits, and they raised the amount of Supreme Court justices to seven. And then later on, in the late 1800s. They changed the amount of Supreme Court justices to nine. Guess why? Because there were nine circuit courts. And that's because we were getting more and more population in the country, and we were taking up more and more area. So we had to add the amount of circuit courts. So by the late 1800s, there were nine. So we changed the amount of Supreme Court justices to correlate with the amount of circuit courts in the country. And guess how many there are now? More than nine is a correct guess. A more accurate correct guess would be 13. And it's been that way for quite a long time. And there have many times been talk of expanding the amount of Supreme Court justices. And it always gets knocked down. But it's not going against the Constitution to add Supreme Court judges. It is, in fact, not stacking, quote-unquote, the Supreme Court by adding more Supreme Court justices. It is merely updating the Supreme Court to correlate with the amount of circuit courts in the country. And the reason we have more circuit courts than we used to is because we have more people than we used to. It's not rocket surgery, people. So, yeah. Here's an interesting story. Let's go local. This, again, is being written by Dina Winter at our favorite Minnesota Reformer. They're a great news outlet if you don't know about them. It's MinnesotaReformer.com. And this is another story about Matt Burke and what he doesn't know and doesn't understand about things. Republican Lieutenant Governor candidate Matt Burke incorrectly said in a Saturday Facebook post that all Minnesota so-called crisis pregnancy centers are privately funded. In fact, $3.4 million in state dollars annually goes to these so-called crisis pregnancy centers, which are organizations that encourage women to carry their pregnancies to term rather than terminate. Burke made the false statement while talking about his concern over recent vandalism of anti-abortion crisis pregnancy centers. These anti-abortion centers often advertise themselves in a way that makes them appear to be abortion providers. So then you get women going in there who need an abortion or want an abortion. And then this place, their goal is to dissuade women from having the abortion. Burke said in this same post that he is on the board of directors at the Wakota Life Center in West St. Paul. And such centers do life-saving work, he said, and provide emotional support, medical care, and supplies to pregnant women who are scared, nervous, and don't have anyone else to turn to. That's what he said. In reality, they fool women into coming to them and then talk them out of having the abortion that they want. He goes on to say, what these pregnancy resources centers do is they actually enable women and families to choose life, and they're not funded by the government. He said they're all funded through private donations. Apparently, Burke isn't aware that the Wakota Life Center was awarded $350,000 per year for 5 years through the State Department of Health's, quote, Positive Alternatives to Abortion program. Last year, 27 Minnesota groups received grants of up to $350,000 annual dollars for 5 years, including Pregnancy Resource Center, like the Wakota, which received the largest grant. Again, we repeat, Matt Burke serves on the board of this place. And he doesn't know that they've been getting $350,000 from the state of Minnesota every year for 5 years. But he's on the board. A little bit more about this program. It started back in 2005, and Republicans pushed hard for it. It's a Minnesota program enacted in 2005, awards grants to organizations that support, encourage, and assist women in carrying their pregnancies to term and caring for their babies after birth. The law requires the programs to provide assistance with medical care, nutrition, housing, and parenting education. They're not allowed to encourage, counsel, or refer clients for abortions. Anyway, just another story about how Matt Burke doesn't understand how things work. Matt Burke thinks he's running a separate campaign. At least he did for a while. He was trying to raise money for his own campaign to be the lieutenant governor of Minnesota, because he apparently didn't know that that's not allowed and that's not how it works. You're just a part of Scott Jensen's campaign to be governor. You're just, if Scott Jensen wins, then you become his lieutenant governor. But you know what, Matt? If Scott Jensen doesn't win, you don't get to be lieutenant governor. because you're not running your own campaign against, I don't know who you think, Peggy Flanagan? You think you and Peggy Flanagan are running against each other, your own campaigns? So you think that if Scott Jensen loses, you still have a chance to be lieutenant governor? That's apparently what Matt Burke thought at least a few months ago, if he doesn't still think that. Yeah, that's who we want. That's who we want. By the way, more Minnesota news. Just today, Governor Tim Walz signed an executive order prohibiting state agencies from helping any investigation that would punish anyone for seeking reproductive health care services that are legal in Minnesota. So Tim Walz sticking up for reproductive rights, health care rights of women. Tim Walz sticking up for women. Republican Party trying to repress women. How far are they going to go? It was another kind of funny thing, angry staffer, an entity on Twitter that I follow. He said, "These SCOTUS decisions are getting dangerously close to Clarence Thomas being 3/5 of a vote and Amy Coney Barrett not being allowed to vote at all." Yeah. I swear to God, I think that if the Republicans had their way, they would take away the vote from women. They're taking away other constitutional amendments. Why not go for that one? Anyway, let's take another short break, and we'll come back and finish out the hour for today. I'm Todd Mickelson, sitting in for Matt McNeil. You're listening to AM 950 Radio, the progressive voice of Minnesota. We'll be right back. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. And we're back. This bulletin just in. Company behind Trump's Truth Social deal hit with federal grand jury subpoenas. The Special Purpose Acquisition Company. It's called SPAC. You know, everything's got to have an acronym. So that's the type of a company, an SPAC. The SPAC behind former President Trump's Truth Social platform has been hit with subpoenas by a federal grand jury. So Truth Social is the thing, you know, Trump got all mad when he got kicked off Twitter. So he's, you know, going to start his own Twitter, basically. And this Truth Social apparently is set up just like Twitter, except it's, you know, letting people lie. Even though it kicks people off, usually it looks like they kick people off for telling the truth. And then so it's kind of like, although it's called Truth Social, it only allows lies. I'm not sure exactly how it works. I haven't been on it. I don't have an account, even though I get emails all the time asking what I want my username to be on Truth Social, along with all the emails I get from Trump and the Republicans telling me I haven't given him money yet. Todd, are you still with us? I think it's pretty funny. And I get a lot of, I mean, many a day, still trying to get money out of me. It's a big swindle. Of course, we knew that. Anyway, a recent 8K, I'm not sure what that is, but a filing that earlier this month, it became aware that a federal grand jury sitting in the Southern District of New York has issued subpoenas to each member of this company's board of directors. Apparently, the company is called Digital World. And each of the board of directors got a subpoena. The filing went on to state that the subpoenas are seeking requests relating to Digital World's S-1 filings, communications with or about multiple individuals, and information regarding Rocket One Capital, a Miami-based hedge fund. The filing warns that these grand jury subpoenas could materially delay, materially impede, or prevent the consummation of the merger that's needed to fund Truth Social. Earlier this month, it was revealed that the Securities and Exchange Commission was investigating the Truth Social deal, with a particular focus on whether illegal negotiations occurred prior to Digital World acquisition went public. This is the first indication, however, that the investigation has potentially risen to a criminal level. So, yeah, Trump is basically a bad version of Tony Soprano. Pretty much everything he touches, it ends up being a criminal investigation and subpoenas issued. The deal that they're making, the money deal that they're making, is at a criminal level. You know, it reminds me of, again, we're talking about the Supreme Court. For the Brett Kavanaugh seat, if you remember, Justice Kennedy suddenly stepped down. Now, Justice Kennedy's son was working with Trump through Deutsche Bank. Now, of course, we all have heard, and who knows what's still probably going to happen with Deutsche Bank and all of the information about illegalities going on with Trump. Deutsche Bank is the only bank that will deal with Trump. All the other banks have slowly pulled away from him over the decades because, you know, he's not actually rich. He's just a low level mobster, and no other banks would give him any loans for him to survive in the way that he survives. Justice Kennedy's son was apparently getting mixed up in some nefarious things, but no investigation ended up happening. And Kennedy stepped down right after there's video of him and Trump walking in a hallway in the White House, and just before Trump pulls him into this room to have a talk with him, Justice Kennedy kind of looks astonished. Trump kind of says something. You can't hear any of it. Trump kind of says something to him, and Justice Kennedy stops and winces and kind of leans away from Trump and abruptly looks at him like he's startled. And then Trump kind of puts his arm around him.
No, it'll be all right. Come on in. Let's have a talk. Okay, it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. You're going to be fine. Your son's going to be fine. I wouldn't want anything bad to happen to your son. But, you know, Justice Kennedy, we could really use an opening on the Supreme Court right now. You know, you're looking old. You're maybe not what you used to be. I'd hate for something to happen to your son.
It was right after that happened that Justice Kennedy stepped down from the Supreme Court, opening up the seat that then Brett Kavanaugh was put in. By the way, Brett Kavanaugh had like $250,000 in debt that mysteriously went away as well. Who paid for that? People still ask. Inquiring minds would like to know, what is all the mobster crap that went down there? Here's some more good news. Last week, even as the January 6th committee was preparing to hold public hearings incriminating Trump DOJ official Jeffrey Clark, who we talked about earlier, the news broke that the DOJ had executed a search and seizure warrant at Clark's home the day before. In that same time frame, the DOJ also seized the cell phone of the Nevada Republican Party chair and subpoenaed numerous fake electors. At the time, it was pointed out that when these kinds of stories surface in the media, they tend to only be a fraction of what's actually going on, and the rest of the story only comes out later. Sure enough, CNN is now reporting that the DOJ also carried out a search and seizure warrant against Trump election attorney John Eastman on that same day. Interestingly, the Eastman news is only becoming public because Eastman himself is complaining about it, while the Clark news only appeared to become public for similar reasons. The DOJ itself does not tend to make these kinds of law enforcement actions public until it brings indictments. Anything that leaks out ahead of time is usually only because the target runs to the media or a neighbor sees the feds or something like that. This points to Clark and Eastman both being criminal targets. It further suggests that the DOJ is criminally targeting all of Trump's top underlings in an effort to pressure one or more of them into flipping on Trump himself. If the DOJ is going to charge Trump, it would typically want one or more inside witnesses testifying against him in order to ensure high odds of conviction. That's how that works. So basically now these guys are going to be grilled and they're going to – if they're – you know, if it's gone this far and they're threatening indictments, these guys are going to say, what are we looking at? How many months am I looking at? Oh, we're looking at years, Mr. Eastman. Okay. What do you guys want? What do you want from me? Can we please make it months instead of years in prison? We could maybe make it less years in prison. But you're going to have to tell us something that we don't already know. And you may be too late for that. So things are falling apart. And now we have a January 6th hearing very suddenly being scheduled for tomorrow because there seems to be some sort of urgency to it. And it sounds like we're going to find out in the noon hour tomorrow. They usually take about 2 hours, so probably between noon and 2 p.m. It sounds like we're going to find out a whole bunch more about the unbelievableness or we're going to – I can't even speculate. This has just been – blowing my mind and surprising me so much, I can't even speculate. Chris on Twitter makes a very short, poignant point. A message to undecided voters. The economy will come back. Your rights may not. So, undecided voters, vote. And vote for your rights. For more than partying in this country, we basically have to defend democracy. This has been fun. I hope you had fun, too. I'll be back tomorrow and Wednesday. Matt is on vacation for the rest of the week. I'm Todd Mickelson, signing off along with Patrick on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. We'll see you tomorrow.